From Luminary Media, this is the Blacklist Podcast. I am Blacklist founder Franklin Leonard, one of your co-hosts, but the better co-host is...
I'm Kate Hagen, director of community at the Blacklist.
Our guest today is Liz Hanna, who I first found out about when she was, I think, tied for number two on the 2016 Blacklist with a script called The Post. The script about Katharine Graham and the Washington Post during the Pentagon Papers kept getting all these votes and then ended up towards the top. And then within weeks, Steven Spielberg, Meryl Streep, and Tom Hanks attached themselves to make the movie, and it obviously got made. And as I've told Liz, it's pretty much all downhill from there for a writer, except it really hasn't been. Right, Kate?
Yeah, I think the incredible thing about Liz is that she is having the kind of career that most screenwriters dream of. Besides The Post, Liz has also recently worked on Long Shot, which was one of my favorite movies of last year and a real shot in the arm for the romantic comedy genre, as well as a couple projects for Netflix, two very different projects, actually. She was on season two of Mindhunter, the dark true crime drama, and she also recently adapted All the Bright Places, which is currently available on Netflix. And as you see when we talk to Liz, her inspirations and influences are really wide-ranging and interesting. Everybody from Nora Ephron to Katharine Graham to Woodward and Bernstein. And I think that that really shows in the work that she's been able to produce so far.
And that is why I say that she's the better co-host, Kate Hagen, everybody. When you put it like that, it is sort of wild, right? She's done a massively successful serious drama, a massively successful big studio romantic comedy, which is not really a genre that even exists anymore, and then a serious dark thriller television series for Netflix and a young adult thing for Netflix. Quite a range, and all of that in only 4 years.
Liz is great. You're going to hear a lot of her insight into her process in our conversation with her today.
And a little bit of college basketball too, which you may be surprised to find I'm not the most knowledgeable about this conversation out of the three of us. It's pretty much just Liz and Kate talking about college basketball and me sitting silently.
You can find us on Twitter for our many opinions about men's college basketball. Just don't ask us about Christian Laettner.
No one should ask anybody about Christian Laettner ever, even Christian Laettner. That is my humble opinion. And I'm sure there are people who disagree, but they're wrong. Anyway, here is my and Kate's conversation with Liz Hanna. Enjoy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Okay, Liz, first question. It's the first question we ask everyone. First movie you saw in a theater?
I remember my first theater experience. I can't say that it was definitely my first movie I saw in a theater, but it was Jurassic.
That's fair.
That was Jurassic Park. And I was like 5, 6, 7. I was probably like 7 when it came out, or 8. And I was with my parents, and they were like, oh, dinosaurs, you can see it. And I remember physically jumping when the raptor jumps out at Laura Dern.
Oh, yeah.
And I elevated out of the seat, and then I stood in front of my mom behind the seat in front of me, grasping the seat in front of me for like the rest of the movie.
But still watching it though.
Oh yeah, no,
head sort of peaked above.
Yeah, I wasn't hiding. I was like, I'm mobile. In case a raptor comes, I can just get out of the way. Yeah.
I feel like that's a good one. It makes me feel
old. Were you a
dinosaur
kid? Because I feel like a lot of kids in the 90s were dinosaur kids.
Well, have you talked to Brian Duffield? Because then that's
exactly
the dinosaur kid. I was I was like a Amblin kid. So that was like, I was Indiana Jones and all of that. And so, and Romancing the Stone was really big for me. So I was like an adventure sort of Spielberg-y, Zemeckis-y kid. And so that, I think that was why my parents took me.
So those were like the first movies that you like sort of watched at home.
Yeah, and then
it was like, okay, she's clearly into this
sort of thing. Yeah.
Let's take her to the super scary dinosaur movie.
Let's take her to the completely inappropriate film for a 7-year-old to watch. Although
it's really scary.
It's funny because now I look at it and I'm like, what kids watch nowadays is probably so much scarier. But like they're just because of video games and stuff, they're so dulled down to it. But like I remember those dinosaurs looked real. And the crazy thing is like I watched part of it the other day and I was like, the effects are pretty good.
It still
because they're mostly real,
It still holds. I think that movie holds up. I mean, actually, that was for me the movie that made me want to like, movies matter. Like I saw it 3 times opening weekend in the theater. Because I was old. It was also the first movie I could go by myself with my friends, and my parents didn't feel compelled to be there. It holds up.
It totally holds up. There's a great documentary actually about it, like a making of, and this is a very Steven Spielberg-y thing because it also happened with E.T., where he was talking about the breathing of the dinosaurs, animatronics, and it's like, if they don't breathe and they don't blink, people will know they're fake.
Yeah.
And with E.T., he did this whole thing about the eyes of E.T. and how they had to be humanized because that would be like welcoming for children instead of scary. And I think is actually the thing, if you think about Jurassic Park and the dinosaurs and you kind of look at other animatronics or things like that, that is the significant difference, is that they feel very real because they're breathing and their heart rate is changing as they're getting excited and things like that.
What's wild about that is that if I'm remembering this correctly, they draw specific attention to it the first time you see the dinosaur, because he literally
lays on top of it
and you see him rise and fall. Yeah. So it like accentuates the detail that makes it real.
Which is like that's such an attention to detail thing to think about. Like I would just be like, dope dinosaurs. And make sure they blink and breathe and have heart rates.
Exactly.
Like,
and their blood pressure accurately reflects the extent of their stress.
Are they getting 10,000 steps a day? Because that's important.
Exactly.
I don't know. I think kids today would still be pretty freaked out by the real dinosaurs, though, because like nothing in Avengers has weight like the dinosaurs Jurassic Park have weight, and you're like, wait, but this is like an object in 3-dimensional space like it's true. I would love to show like a bunch of 7-year-olds Jurassic Park just to like get their
reviews. Sure, we could.
My
younger brother, I showed him, I wasn't allowed to show him Jurassic Park because of my experience, but I showed him when he was like 7, I showed him Willy Wonka, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And that was a traumatizing experience. Like, I got halfway through and they went through the rainbow tunnel and I was like, we should just watch something else. This is like this is not appropriate. Scary.
I have told this story before. I was really traumatized by the Oompa Loompas as a kid.
That's fair.
And now apparently Taika is bringing them back.
Yeah, he's doing the animated version.
Yeah.
It's still going to be scary. I have no doubt.
I think with Taika, it's definitely going to be scary.
I'm not excited about it. Taika is a friend. I'm sorry, Taika, if you're listening to this, but there's a very good chance I will never watch this because of literally childhood trauma.
I was just going to say, all that Roald Dahl stuff is so dark and so weird. And like, Matilda is fun and cute, but still very dark. Like, all of those adaptations, like, they got to be weird to really like land it.
It's also, for kids, like, I think, or teenagers specifically, are probably the people who relate to it, but it's like, the weirder the better, because you feel weird as a teenager, so you're like seeing the external that you're feeling internally, like it sort of logically makes sense, but then as a 7-year-old you're like, this scared the shit out of me.
Pretty much.
During this time, is there a single movie that sort of catalyzes from I like movies, I enjoy watching movies, to I love movies, I'm a movies kid, this is my jam?
I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark was the first movie that sort of, as you were talking about Jurassic Park, like that was the first movie that I watched and then watched consistently over and over and over again and was like, whatever this is, I want to be a part of this.
And this is pre-Jurassic Park for
you. This is pre-Jurassic Park, yeah.
So you were on the movie I want to do movies thing even younger than your first theatrical experience.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was. Right. I was just like, I love this and I love being a part of this. Both my parents are really big like movie fans, my mom in particular, and so we wouldn't watch a lot of TV. We would watch movies. And going to the movies was like a big experience and all that. Like when I was in high school, we would go once a week to the movies and see whatever was
like the whole family.
My mom and I. My mom and I. Okay. Yeah. And so my mom and I would go like every Thursday, I think we would just go and watch a movie, whatever was out, like sort of, although we didn't do horror movies. What you were saying about Taika being friends, like I have a lot of friends who make genre films and I'm always like, I'm going to watch it at 11 o'clock in the morning in my house with all the lights on under a blanket when it's streaming.
That is my plan for Candyman.
Yeah.
And that is the only time I will say the title of that movie in this podcast interview.
That's, I'm uncomfortable that you stated that.
41 years old, still won't say it five times in a mirror.
Well, that's just smart.
All right. And so, okay, so what is the weirdest way you've ever watched a movie? Like location, circumstances surrounding it? Like my answer for this is I actually watched like Water for Chocolate in the back room of a bar in Durban, South Africa.
I mean, I would say that I like this isn't a weird place, but probably a situation I would not like to repeat is that I saw a scary movie with my father in a movie theater. And that was probably the moment where I was like, I'm going to read the synopsis before I go see movies with my dad again, because there's a guy who gets killed with a dick in the ear. And I was sitting next to my father as that was happening. And I was like, all right. This was also like around the same time we watched Slums of Beverly Hills together with his then girlfriend, now wife of 20 years. And I was like, this is a bonding experience I'm not really interested in having. So yeah, I would say I'm more situationally weird. I always feel like watching, I'm sorry to everybody. And by the way, I just made a movie for Netflix, so I'm the person. But I feel like watching a movie on my phone is always the weirdest. Like regardless of place, it's just a very isolating thing. And I feel like it's not how I'm supposed to experience whatever it is. So that actually for me, probably singularly any time that happens, I'm like, ugh, this is weird.
But do you feel like you watch movies, you find yourself watching movies on your phone though now? Like even though it is weird and even though it is certainly not as most filmmakers intend, I think we all may find ourselves doing it.
Yeah, I've definitely found myself doing it, particularly in places where I'm like, I don't have the internet. Like if I don't have, like I have one of those very stupidly big iPads because I like to read and do notes on it. And so but I don't have like the internet, I have Wi-Fi, that's it.
Right.
And so like if I'm someplace where I want to watch something and I don't have access to it, I will watch it on my phone. Like the other day when I was feeling really miserable about the state of our world, I was like, I'm going to watch the West Wing pilot. But I could only watch it on my phone. And so then, and that was a very weird experience to be like, I also know this pilot so well that I don't really need to watch it. I just kind of need the like aura, the ether of it in my head.
Right.
So yeah, I do find myself doing it though. I find myself watching like dailies on my phone all the time.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, that's a convenience thing if nothing else because, and you're not, it's not the full cinematic, it's not intended to be the full cinematic experience. So. Yeah.
Just don't tell David Lynch you're watching movies on your phone.
Yeah, I know, right?
I'd love to know a bit more about how you came to write the post.
Yes.
How did you first get introduced to Katharine Graham? Why were you motivated to tell her story? You know, and what was it like to get the call from Steven Spielberg?
Yeah, we got to break that up into a few different questions because I've heard versions of the story before and it's an amazing one. So let's start with the idea.
Okay, so
set the scene. Where are you in life and how do you decide this is what I'm going to write?
I think I was 22 when I read Personal History by Katharine Graham, her memoir. I always want to shout it out because it's an exceptional, exceptional book. Won the Pulitzer Prize, so anybody who hasn't read it should read it. I was working in development at the time, was super inspired by the book and by her and found her voice to be unique in that. She was very self-reflective, which obviously I think you are in a memoir, but she was very critical of herself and very, you know, the thing that really struck me is there's a few chapters after Katharine's husband, Philip Graham, had committed suicide when her kids were young and you know, not adults. And there's a few chapters after that about the aftermath of his suicide and how she didn't deal with it well with the children and didn't talk about it. And it's this very personal reflection about how she could have dealt with it better and how she didn't. And she also didn't know. I mean, this was in the 60s.
Right. Yeah. Like mental health and self-care wasn't really like a thing the same way
at all. And, you know, there was really, I mean, he had been diagnosed as bipolar, but nobody knew how to treat that. Nobody knew what that was. And so it was an unfortunate, obviously, sort of circumstances. And so that chapter really grabbed me of how she was basically apologizing to her children, but not asking for anything. Right. And so I thought that was really remarkable. So I read that. I was really drawn to it. I found out that the Graham family was, you know, never gonna, I didn't even think about making it into a movie, really. I was just like, I love this person. She should be, people should know about her.
Right.
One of Katharine Graham's things was like, I don't want this movie. I don't want this to be a movie. And so then I went through my life and I ended up leaving my job when I was 27 to write full time because I was like, this will be easy. that was sarcasm for people who can't see my voice or my face. And I was struggling for years. I was, you know, I couldn't really write something that was about my voice, was my voice, I felt like, was something that I was really passionate about. You know, I grew up loving Sorkin films, Sidney Pollack films, 70s thrillers. And so I really couldn't get in that world. And that wasn't really a world that was of movies that was being made.
Right.
And so I was going to go back. Yeah.
But what were you writing during that phase?
I had written a
like, are you writing those kinds of things?
No, and they're just, not at all. No, okay. I was like writing things that I thought would get me an agent. And I had my two managers. And my lawyer, I didn't have an agent. I was writing on a digital series about teenagers. I was like, I was literally just writing to make ends meet and not making ends meet very well. And, you know, I wrote a romantic comedy. I wrote a few different things that I was like, this is what people think I should write.
Right.
Because, I mean, also, to be honest, I was like, I'm a girl. Is anybody going to hire a girl to write a political thriller? And so I was going to go back. I was really, really not in a good mental health state, frankly, where I was like, I'm really depressed. I feel like nobody's going to let me write what I want to write. And instead of whining and being a victim about it, I'm just going to go back and work in development. And I loved working in development. And I was like, maybe it's just not supposed to happen to me for being a writer. And my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, who this is the only reason I married him, obviously. No, I love you very much, honey. I'm sure you're listening to this. He was like, before you quit, you should probably write the Katharine Graham movie that you've been talking about for years.
Oh, wow.
And so in that time, I had been researching Katharine Graham. I'd been reading Ben Bradley's books. I've been reading, you know, the good thing about when you write about journalists is they've all written a book about it. So right. I was reading all of the books about it. And I was like, well, I don't really know. Does anybody write it? And he was like, just write it. He was like, take the summer and write it. And so
was there a reason you hadn't tried to write it already? Like, clearly you're doing the research, like you care about this subject. Is it one of those things that you're just like, it has to be the right moment. I have to be able to nail it. Or was it like there's no reason to write this because there's no way it ever gets made? Like,
it was a little bit of both. Okay. I mean, the biggest thing is I was terrified because I was like, I don't want to mess this up. Right. I didn't want to get it wrong. I tend to write for actors in my head, regardless of how crazy it is. And so I was like, Meryl is the only person who could play this. And how crazy is that for me to write something and be like, Meryl Streep will play this part?
Utterly insane.
It's absolutely insane. Yeah. So I had a really hard time kind of motivating myself to do it. And then my husband was very, very much was like, you should just do it. Like, just stop. You know, you can't quit if you haven't done this one thing. And he was like, if this doesn't work, fine, let's talk about it. But like that's not what, you shouldn't do that before you've written it. So I sat down, I finally wrote it. It took me about 3 months when I finally opened my laptop. The first draft was 165 pages, which again, my sweet, sweet husband read, and then whittled it down. And I had been talking to this production company called Star Thrower Entertainment, Tim and Trevor White. I'd known them for a few years. I'd like met them on a general when I first went out to write full time. And had mentioned this, and they had grown up in DC, and so they knew, and they'd be really interested. And every like 8 months, they'd email me and be like, "How's that going?" And I'd be like, "It's great, it's great, it's great." Meanwhile, I'd have like a panic attack, and I was like, "It's not great. I haven't written anything."
Right. I read the Bradley book last week, but that's about it.
And so I also to answer your question, I mean, a big part of it was also about a biopic is like, what is the version of the story you're going to tell? Like, I don't think a cradle to grave biopic is for me something that I could write or would want to watch, and. That's a very rare movie that could do that. You're like Benjamin Button or Forrest Gump. And that's not even really Cradle to the Grave.
And those are fiction.
And those are fiction. Benjamin Button is fiction?
I know, it's crazy.
House. That
We're
was
learning
although,
a lot today.
Increasingly, I'm not convinced it's not the Brad Pitt story.
It's
the man does not age.
It's upsetting.
And maybe he's aging in reverse. Who knows?
He's just going to be back to like Thelma and Louise days like 5 years from now.
At
like,
this okay point, it yeah, would fine. Not shock me.
Everyone gasped in the movie theater I was in when he took his shirt off.
Same.
It was just remarkable. But so anyways, with The Post, a lot of it was I couldn't figure out what the story was. And when I had read Bradley's memoir and really saw kind of the change of their relationship and the dynamic change of all the journalists even and the editorial staff during the Pentagon Papers. I was like, oh, this is the moment, because it was really the moment that Katharine Graham found her voice. I tend to believe that the best of biopics, maybe even the best of movies, are coming of age stories, or, you know, sort of fundamentally. And so that was where that came, kind of really started to come to stark relief. And so sat down and wrote it. I sent it to Tim and Trevor at Star Thriller on a Friday. I got engaged on Saturday. And on Monday, they were like, let's figure out how to make this movie.
I got to go back for 1 second.
Yeah.
So you finish the script.
Yeah.
You send it.
Yeah.
And your now husband proposes the next day.
Yes.
I assume, was he waiting until the script was done? Or
no.
Was he, it was just already planned for that Saturday?
It was Labor Day
and it
weekend.
It just happened to work that way.
Yeah.
Okay, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was Labor Day weekend. He also, like, had tricked me. I knew he was going to propose because right. we'd been together for a while. He also can't lie. And so he, like, I knew the moment he came home with the engagement ring, because he was like, hey, what's up? And, like, went into the bedroom. And I was like, you're being weird. And so that's a whole
Got
other
it.
Conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so he proposed on Saturday, and then Monday or Tuesday, it was Labor Day. So Tuesday they were like, we want to make the movie. Let's figure out how to make it. I didn't have an agent. So they were like, let's take it to a few agencies.
Right.
Whoever you sign with, we can help package the movie
right.
with talent. We'll make this movie for $5 million. And, you know, it'll be this tiny little movie, but we'll be really happy about it.
Right.
I was like, great. Meet with a few agents. And then in the process of meeting with the agents, and this is like October 2016, towards the end of the month, the script gets slipped to Fox.
Right.
And then over the course of the next sort of, that was like a Thursday night. And then over the next 12 hours, it had been slipped throughout the whole town.
Right.
And it became a bidding war the next day. And Amy Pascal called me at midnight and was like, I'm going to buy your script and let's make this movie. And it was like this crazy, at every step of the way, I was like, this isn't going to happen.
Right.
They're never going to make this movie. Da da da. Which then even continued, because then the election was, you know, 4 days later
right.
and Donald Trump was elected. And we were like, nobody wants to watch a movie about women. Like, I was like, if
right.
that felt really disheartening. And Amy, to her credit, was like, we have to make this even more now. We spent some time looking for a director. It got on the blacklist. Script got on the blacklist.
Yeah.
Shout out. And I really was getting everything I thought that I could get from this. You know, I'd signed
right.
with an agent. I was writing the types of movies I wanted to write.
It's almost as if writing the thing that you cared most about was what you should have been doing all along.
Hey, it's this crazy thing that happens. But I actually am a big believer in the thing that you're the most afraid of, be it with work or your personal life.
Yeah.
The second you do it, all of these things open up. So like when I left my job when I was 27, I met my husband like 2 months later.
Yeah.
And so it's this, it doesn't always happen the way you think it'll happen, but you know, it's, I think that is really, yeah, it was, writing the post was like the scariest thing I ever could have done. And it ended up changing my life. Yeah.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So tell us about, like, getting the call. I assume it was – which happened first, Spielberg, Hanks, or Meryl, and what was it like getting each of those three calls, especially given the fact that you had literally had them in mind as you wrote the
poem? Yeah, it was really weird. It all happened basically at the same time, actually. Okay. So there was this confluence of events that happened in January, February, where Trump went into office and started kicking journalists out of the press room and out of the West Wing. Tom Hanks sent an espresso machine to the press room at the White House, which he does every time there's a new administration. And he put a Ben Bradley quote on a post-it on it. Meryl was, being very outspoken about the press and about the responsibility of us all to allow the press to do their jobs. Mm-hmm. And Steven was casting a film that was in prep. He was supposed to start shooting it in like 6 weeks. But the lead of the film was a 7-year-old boy and he couldn't find him. Right. And he'd gone through like 10,000 casting, 10,000 auditions, couldn't find him. All of them had wanted to work together. Meryl and Tom had never worked together, and Steven and Meryl had never worked together. So it was this like they'd all kind of been looking for something. And I'm not sure where, because it's been a little convoluted in my head at this point, but one of them got the script first, and then it all went to the three of them. Right. And then I got a call. And the other important sort of emotional piece of this was, so there's one quote on the back of Personal History, and it's by Nora Ephron. And Nora has been a huge inspiration for me, a huge idol for me.
Yeah.
And when Amy first bought the book, bought the script, she was like, Nora would have loved to have made this, you know, and she knew Nora very well. So then in the confluence of this, obviously, Meryl and Nora had made many moves together, knew each other. Tom and Meryl and Nora hadn't made many moves together. And Stephen and Nora had been neighbors in the Hamptons.
That's right.
Next to Ben Bradley.
That part I did not know.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So all of this confluence of events happens. I think it's like a Sunday night or a Monday night. I was actually really sick. I had like a flu or something. And Amy was like, you have to come to my office right now. And I was like, Amy, I don't even think I can drive. Like right. I am. She was like, get in an Uber and come to my office. And I was like, okay, go to her office. And Steven was on the phone and he was like, we're going to make this movie and we're dedicating the movie to Nora. And that was really the thing for me that made it. I mean, regardless of Steven being like, I'm making this movie. Right. Tom's playing Ben Bradley. Meryl Streep is playing Katherine Graham. Right. But then actually the real emotional part was that we're going to dedicate the movie to Nora, and that it was this sort of like passion project for everybody at that point.
Did you cry? I would have cried.
I mean, I was really high on cold medicine, so I probably did. Yeah. It was really, honestly, it was so surreal. None of it really, really hit me until much later. Like, even because they signed on, we were shooting less than 10 weeks later.
Right.
So there was no time to really process it because I had like a script meeting with Steven the next day and I was like, hey, Steven Spielberg. This was a very whirlwind experience. So it really wasn't until I would even say like we wrapped and we were kind of all just there together. We didn't have a wrap party because we had kind of disparate cast at all times, and we had one day where we were shooting the Supreme Court stuff and we had almost the entire cast, and so Josh Singer, my co-writer on the project, we took them out to a bar in Harlem because we were shooting at Columbia, and so we found this bar in Harlem and like the whole cast was there or almost the whole cast was there who had been in town, and that was actually when it hit me where I was just like, not only was this a crazy experience, but it was like remarkable people that I got to make it with and really lovely people that want to all sit down and have a conversation and be like, that was crazy. Right. So it was really, it was a crazy experience.
Yeah.
How do you psych yourself up for the notes meeting with Spielberg?
Honestly, it's the fact that it's like happening in 12 hours, so you don't have time to freak out about it. A lot of this movie I honestly felt blessed for this speed of it, because if I had had a moment to be like, so now I'm going to go meet with Tom Hanks, so now I'm going to go talk to Meryl Streep, so now I'm going to have another script meeting with Steven Spielberg where we're going to talk about like every I would be so freaked out.
I have heard, and this might be apocryphal, that Spielberg does that a lot, that the way that he works, particularly with people with whom he's never worked before, is to have an incredibly rapid process where people don't have a lot of notice, even for like, I read a script by a writer. Mm-hmm. I would like them in my office tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I suspect, and I've heard at least one person tell me this, that the reason he does that is that he knows the effect that reality has on people. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't want people to have to sit with it and sort of, you know, paralyze themselves because it's like, oh my God, I'm sitting down with Spielberg next week. It's like, I guess I'm sitting down with Spielberg tomorrow. I don't have time to be stressed about it. So it makes sense to me.
That totally makes sense. I mean, Steven is also really lovely and humble and not intimidating in like the way, right, in his presence.
In the way you that know? You think he would be being Steven Spielberg.
Exactly. Yeah. And very, I think the thing that is about him that makes him that is he's very curious. And so he's not condescending or higher than art though, which he could be because he's Steven Spielberg. But he's actually just very curious. And so like my first script meeting with him a lot was questions. He was like, so what was the intention of this movie? Why did you say this? What did you say this about? Like, and so it was not like, I think this should happen here. It was very curious of like trying to fully grasp what the intention of each scene and each choice and stuff like that. So then we could move from there and have a conversation about it, which I think that is a great way to start also with a writer who has to interrupt you after 10 minutes and be like, Marion Ravenwood is my favorite female character.
Look, all of the greats in my experience are unusually curious. It is the one thing that has bound together all of the people who I've worked with, who I've been in awe of.
Absolutely.
All of them.
And I think in cinema in particular, we're all, I mean, I wouldn't say all, but for the most part, a lot of us are here to like analyze the human condition, mm-hmm, or explore it and explore sort of the gray area of life and humanity. And so I think the only way to actually do that is to continually be curious and to continually ask people what their lives are like and why they're doing things they're doing.
You're going to like the next two questions then. Okay, I'll let you ask the terrible movie question and then I'll ask the next one.
Yeah.
Since this has already come up.
So we love to talk about our favorite movies that no one else likes. What is your favorite sort of considered to be terrible, less than 25% on Rotten Tomatoes movie that you will defend to your grave?
This is a great question. I don't know if it's less than 25%, so I'm going to just shout it out, thinking that it might be. Armageddon is fantastic. I'll fight about that to the grave.
In the Criterion Collection.
Is it really?
It is. That and The Rock are early days Criterions.
I did not know that. I suspect Armageddon is better than 25%, but now I'm actually genuinely curious what it is.
By the way, I'm sure I have like 1,000 of these that are not great. But on the spot, that's the one I can really think about of like, not a great movie, but like a good movie. And one that if it's on television, I'm like, I'm going to watch it. Oh, another one that I don't know what the Rotten Tomato score is, but another one that sort of has been lost in film canon is the updated The Italian Job.
Ooh.
That's a very good movie.
It's pretty great.
Totally agree.
And
I totally
agree. Anytime it's on TV, I'm like, I'm going to watch that. We used to call it our packing movie. It's like, if it's, you know what I mean? You're like, oh, I can totally have this on while I'm packing. And it's really fun and everybody's good in it. I'm a big Italian Job fan.
It's too bad until a couple of years ago, there was an Italian Job themed ride at Paramount's Kings Island in Cincinnati. You could have ridden it.
I could have. Yeah. I could have.
So I just looked it up. Armageddon is a 38 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay, so
definitely,
yeah,
definitely qualifies. Yep. And the Italian Job, I think quite appropriately, is 73.
Good.
Yeah, I'm
proud of that. There's one thing that definitely deserves a 22, which is Edward Norton's mustache in it. That's the only thing I was saying.
I forgot he was in that.
I forgot
he plays the bad guy.
He's the bad guy. You got Seth Green hacking the traffic lights.
Jason Statham.
That's right.
Yeah,
it was also the introduction of like the Mini Cooper, right? Like that was the big.
Which I drive now, ironically. Maybe this is a, are we in therapy? Is this what we're talking about?
It's funny. So my first executive job in Hollywood, I was working on developing the Italian Job sequel.
With Purvis and Wade writing?
No, it was previous to that. I can't even remember who the writers were. It was a husband and wife couple. And it's funny because
I would have loved that.
I was really surprised that they never figured it out because I really feel like that was one that could have been like that you could have done multiples of. And it's ironic because I feel like on some level, Fast and Furious stepped into that void.
100%.
And that's why it worked. Because it's the same thing. Cars, a sort of, you know, disparate crew of like, you know, people working together, but not.
Point Break with Cars. Yeah.
Point Break with Cars. Exactly.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the thing about Italian Job that I guess makes sense that it didn't work, but is the thing that makes it work really is that the cast is crazy. Charlize, Mark Wahlberg,
exactly.
Jason Statham, Edward Norton. I'm sure I'm missing people, but it's like, it's crazy.
It really is.
Is it Mos Def?
I think Mos Def.
It is Mos Def. Yeah. Or Dante Beze, I believe is the guy he's going by now.
Okay.
All right, you mentioned Sydney Pollack earlier. Mm. dear to my heart, having worked for him. And one of the things that he told me that I had sort of been burned into my brain is that he was only interested in making movies about two things, love and war, because mm-hmm. they were the only two things that in the history of human, and they sort of in all of human history, we have no greater understanding of now than we did eons ago, mm-hmm. which begets what we are calling the Sydney Pollack question. Favorite movie about love, favorite movie about war?
My favorite movie about love is Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah.
And my favorite movie about war, I might have to take the jump. It might be 1917.
Wow, bold choices. We love to see it.
It is a bold choice. I'm not necessarily going to disagree with you.
Yeah,
and I have other options, but it is, I believe it is strong.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's also, it's recency bias. Is that like,
yeah, 100%.
It's probably the thing. But I mean, I can go A Thin Red Line, I think, is a remarkable film.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, Schindler's List is something that I don't know if that's, I mean, it is about war, obviously. And that is like the movie, you know, whenever I get offered or somebody talks about a World War II movie, I'm like, did Schindler's List do it all? Like, did we,
right.
should I really, do I want to dip my toe in there?
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, in wars, it's probably that. And then love story is like, you know, Sleepless in Seattle, The Philadelphia Story. Mm. What else I got? Notting Hill is phenomenal.
Agreed.
I'm basically all ride or die for anything Nora's ever touched. And my husband and I had a long conversation recently about You've Got Mail, about like the how good it is.
Watched it again recently. Totally agree.
It's really good.
It is also this very bizarre time capsule of the internet.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's so crazy when you think about it, that movie can't function in the yeah. internet now, because you would just be like, let me Google this.
Well, by the way, Fox Books is gone because of Amazon.
Well, also, yeah. also that. Yeah. Well, someone should have done the You've Got Mail sequel, obviously, where Fox
Bezos.
Books is in the sort of shop around the corner situation. Yep. I don't know. It's like Bezos. It's like Mackenzie Bezos and yep. Tom Hanks. Yep. I don't know what
I'm
the plot
it.
Line is, but I feel like it's doable.
I read a couple years ago, like a 2010s You've Got Mail ripoff that was a Shop Around the Corner ripoff, and so, it was not good.
Okay.
So there we go. It was really poor. I mean, it's just, it's not Nora, man. Like, it's not Nora.
This is the thing. I mean, when you, I wrote a romantic comedy, and the thing about writing it is like, all you do is that there's a baseline of Nora Ephron and Nancy Myers and a sundry of other people who have done it a lot better. And you are like, if we just kind of are slightly under it or under yeah. it, but can still see the bar, then I feel okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of romantic comedies, one of my favorite movies of last year was definitely Long Shot.
Yes.
Appreciate it.
You know, I feel like we're in this moment where rom-coms are having this kind of mini renaissance, which is really exciting because it's a thrilling genre for many of us. What was exciting to you about re-envisioning the romantic comedy for 2020, particularly in the world of politics, given everything that's going on sort of globally right now?
The world is fine. I don't know what you mean. It's totally okay. I was really, so when I came out of that movie, this Dan Sterling had already written a draft of the script.
Yes. That was on the blacklist.
Correct.
Yeah.
It was on the blacklist. And Dan has said this. So this is, he had written it 10 years ago. And, yeah. and so a lot had changed, and he had changed. He had gotten married, he had kids. And yeah. so there was a kind of a jump in time that this sort of in a time capsule you look at and you're like, here's a time capsule of 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So I came on like 2 or 3 months before production to really help and bring it kind of updated and to really focus on the love story and to make it feel really grounded and real. And it's funny, I was telling a story recently. I wish I could say that this was like, I came in and I was like, guys, I know how to fix this. But it was really like the three of, it was Seth and Jonathan Levine, the director, and Dan and I kind of bashing our heads against the wall, trying to make it better, trying to steal all of Nora's tricks, like trying right. to just do anything to make, you know, how are we going to update this? We're all people who are like uncomfortable talking about feelings. And at lunch, I didn't know any of them before I started doing the movie. And so we would get to know each other and talk. And we ended up talking about like our spouses and why we ended up being with the people we were with, and kind of came down to this conversation of they're our best friends. And that was a conversation that we kind of expanded. We were like, okay, so we haven't seen a movie really where it's about two adults who fall in love with each other and are like, you're the person that I want to wake up to every morning, and when I have a bad day I want to call you.
Right.
And we haven't seen that conversation in a while. We've seen sort of the, like, you know, hijinksy thing. So once that was figured out, that was really exciting. And we were like, Well, now we're just talking about two mature, kind of fucked up people who probably shouldn't be together, but at the end of the day, they're both in love with each other and they're in love with their friendship.
Right.
So that was really where it came from. And that kind of felt oddly not dated and also timeless in a weird way.
Well, I mean, it's When Harry Met Sally.
Exactly.
But you're obviously the only woman in that group of four.
Yes.
And it is obviously a script. And I think a lot of this was in the original draft, but it's about a woman who's a badass. Mm-hmm. And I think we all know that there are frustrations, obstacles, genuine impediments to being a badass woman in the world in 2020. How did you guys talk about that aspect of, you know, the woman Secretary of State who's a presumptive president?
Oh, well, that was just a knife to the heart. So part of it is I'd worked for Shirley's when I was starting out. So I had worked for her in development. So I'd known her for a long time. It was one of the reasons that I came on was because of my relationship with her and knowing her. And a lot of it was, this is who she is as a person and something we wanted to put in the script. She's really funny. She's really smart. She's very dry, and she can be very intimidating. And that, like, is a real woman in power for me, as somebody who can put up with the bullshit for just long enough and then is like, all right, I'm done now. Like, I'm actually the person who's going to make the decision, so everybody go away.
Right.
And so putting her humor and humanity into the script was really important to me and to the whole team. And, you know, I would say it is interesting because of those four people, I'm the only woman, but I would say it was something we were all really tuned into and something we were all very aware of as we were rewriting the script and as we were talking about what her motivations were and what her complications were. And Charlize was very involved in how she felt the character should be motivated, et cetera. So I've had experiences, of course, where, I mean, almost every experience I've had, I'm the only woman in the room.
Right.
A movie I'm developing right now is the first time I've worked with a female director. And so, you know, that's not a foreign experience for me, but I will say in this, it was such a warm place of, like, I didn't ever feel like you guys are talking about the girl, I'm over here. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I didn't feel like, hey guys, cool conversation. Do you want to ask the girl what she thinks? I felt actually very much like, they were like, what do you think of this? And da, da, da. And they would also push back on being like, making her really bawdy and making her, you know, one of the scenes that is one of my favorite scenes I've ever been a part of, and something we had kind of very early on, was we wanted, you know, her to get really fucked up.
It's a great scene.
Yeah.
It is a truly great scene.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to get her, we wanted her to get really fucked up, and then we wanted her to have to negotiate a hostage crisis.
Yeah.
And so that scene we were writing pretty early. And one of the things we were talking about is, like, we just don't want to make her look stupid. Like, we don't want to make her look like this is a bad decision that you've made.
Right.
We need, so it was actually helpful to have that moment in the script to lead up to, because we were like, we don't want to look like she's irresponsible. We want to actually be with her when she's like, I need to take some drugs.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, you should.
You should. Yeah, exactly. This is the right decision for you right now.
Yes.
And then, oh no.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Stuck the landing.
Thank you. Charlize I think she's incredible in that. And it's a really hard scene to play. It's probably the hardest scene in the movie for her. And she's so funny in it.
I'm just available for a litany of other Charlize and Seth Rogen rom-coms. I think Seth is the romantic leading man of our times, and nobody is acknowledging that except you guys. So I'm here for it.
I would agree. I think he is. It was, you know, a lot of people pushed back when the movie came out or when they were talking about it. It was like, oh, like Seth with another hot blonde. And I'm like, have you guys met Seth? Because, like, there's a very, like, confident charm about him that I think is this sort of is very captivating. And so, like, I get the conversation.
You get the appeal.
But I get the conversation of, like,
right.
Oh, so this is what, but it's also, that was, I think, part of why we wanted to make this about friends, like, about best friends, and about that is, like, they see something in each other that and nobody else has seen before and that nobody else pushes back on.
Well, there was the, was it the GQ photo shoot that sort of reintroduced everyone to hot Seth? It was with the dog on the beach.
The tropical photos. Yeah. I've been on the Seth Rogen train since Freaks and Geeks, so not news to me. Everybody else.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is just catching up.
All right, let's talk about like the film canon. Another step out. Are there any films in the canon? I'm doing air quotes, but you can't see them. That you just refuse to watch,
like the canon of like. Best films like the of all
great,
time.
Like the great films. Where you're just like, not interested, not watching it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't do horror movies, really. So any real dark horror movies, I won't do. I've seen The Shining, but I probably will never watch it again.
Yeah.
I'm going to go out. It's not that I've not, it's not that I just won't watch it again. Like 2001. I'm not a Kubrick fan. And I know, I understand. Like, right. I grasp the importance of him. Right. And I grasp the importance of his filmmaking. It's just not like Clockwork Orange is not something I'm going to enjoy watching, you know? So that really anything that has like super rapey rape in it, I'm probably not going to get into.
Fair enough. Yeah. No Strange Love though for you on Kubrick? I feel like Strange Love is a Liz Hannah movie.
Strange Love is probably the phrase? The
exception
to the rule.
Fair enough.
That's probably it.
Fair enough. And is there a movie in the canon that like everyone, or even just a movie period, that everyone has been telling you to watch forever and you resisted and then you finally like capitulated and were like, oh damn, y'all were right?
I have to say I'm like a pretty thorough film watcher. Yeah. So I don't have one of those really. My husband made me watch was for years badgering me to watch Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan.
Everybody's husband or boyfriend has done that at some point. Yes. It's like, you have to watch this one, though. Yeah. And you're like, okay, you wore me down, I guess.
I love that Kate jumped in before I got to say, but yeah, you have to watch one. Yeah, I'm a cliche. Well, what did you think?
I thought it was great.
Yes, because it is great.
It's great. And then I watched the one about the whales, and it was really great.
The whales one is also good.
Speaking of, you know, You saying you're not a horror movie person is interesting to me because Mindhunter to me is one of the darkest pieces of entertainment in the last couple of years. And obviously we're dealing with, you know, real evil as opposed to supernatural or otherwise evil there. But how do you sort of, I think one of the things that I'm always most interested in with writers is how do you sort of decompress and rejoin the world when you have spent the day in the Mindhunter writer's room, you're researching these terrible people who have done heinous things. How do you sort of recalibrate back to normal life when you've been immersed in that really dark world?
Wine? Well, what's interesting about that, so the horror thing is like more for me like ghosts and scary houses and like supernatural things, like, excuse me, that's just the stuff that I'm like, well, what if there is a ghost in here? Like, that's scary. Murderers is a little
less... The actual serial killer, not
The actual serial killer is a little less... Like, Silence of the Lambs is one of the, my favorite movies and one of the greatest films ever made. So that, for me, is weirdly less scary because I also think that's about humans and it's psychological and I can handle that. It's like when, you know, like the sea man shows up after you say his name five times. Exactly. Like that type of thing I can't deal with. In Mindhunter, you know, so we didn't have a room for Mindhunter, really. It was just a few of us and kind of writing them in disparate places. We none of us lived in the same place. So we'd like come to L.A. for a few days and sit and do stuff. And then we'd go off. And then we had a number of writers that were freelance for it. And they were wonderful. And we would basically send them an outline and they would write an amazing script off of it. So it was kind of a unique experience. The only thing that really stuck with me for Mindhunter, and I don't usually get affected by things I write. I'm pretty able to like write it and move on. And particularly for Mindhunter, it's a very intellectual process. It's not necessarily a show based on emotion. It's very much based on sort of the reality of what's going on. And I think what was interesting and heartbreaking about this year was writing the Atlanta Child Murders was really actually having the reality of the emotion of the reality of what's happening affecting people rather than Holden and Tench coming in and just being like, we're going to talk about what happened.
Right.
You're actually seeing it happen in real time.
And it, yeah, it's, I mean, I remember watching it and the performances of those mothers.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the best performances I saw last year.
They're exceptional. And I think that was what was emotional about that was writing them. And we really wanted to get it right also. I mean, you're talking about a case that, by the way, for the majority of these mothers, the murderer has not been convicted or tried or arrested for these deaths. And so and for some of them, the bodies were never found. So it's really quite horrendous. And so we wanted to make sure that we were getting it as right as possible. But the thing that stuck with me emotionally, and that was something that I would think about. The thing that really freaked me out and that I was like, I need a break, was writing the BTK stuff. The BTK stuff I found really scary. And that's sort of because I think that is, you know, you're writing about quote unquote experts, you're writing about people who are supposed to know all these things and they had no idea. And that I think is when you're in reality. And there's something that Kemper says in one of the episodes where he's like, it sounds like the only people you're talking to are the ones who wanted to get caught or something along those lines, or the people that you caught, something along those lines. And that just is like a timeless sort of terrifying statement, which is like, oh, cool. So who haven't we caught now?
Yeah. Right.
It's 2020.
It's true.
So I think those are the things that really stick with me and really affect me.
Shout out to June Carroll. I was trying to remember her name. Her performance in Mindhunter is extraordinary.
She's stunning.
Unreal. All the Bright Places?
Yeah. You know, it's nice that I think so far the kind of work that you've been able to do is exactly what you were talking about in your early days of writing, where you're kind of bopping between different things, even though the sort of like political thriller world is where you most feel at home. And recently, All the Bright Places hit Netflix, which you wrote.
That is correct.
Yes. And I think it's a really thoughtful, warm look at, you know, the challenges that contemporary teenagers are facing in not just friendships, romantic relationships, family relationships, but it also gets into some really sort of tricky and thorny mental health issues. What was your process like while you were writing to make sure that you were not only adapting the book the way the book needed to be adapted, but speaking to teenagers who were going to be watching it in a way that was going to be really thoughtful and supportive to them?
Yeah, it's a great question. Jennifer Niven, who wrote the book, based it on true story that happened with her. So it's about a relationship she had with a boy that when she was in high school. And so that knowing that it was not only an impactful story to a number book to a number of people in the world and has a number of fans who it really felt affected and seen by it. I also knew it was a true story that was very close to Jennifer's heart. So there was a lot of responsibility and sort of it was a little bit of a high wire act in adapting it. I think the biggest thing for me was not talking down to anybody and just saying, because you're 17, that doesn't mean that your feelings are any less relevant or any less important or real. And when I wrote the script, the director was not attached. And so Brett Haley, who directed the film, came on I want to say like 3 months before we went to pre-production. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was very, once he signed on, it was very quick. Elle Fanning had been attached and was producing the film. And then subsequently we found Justice Smith, who is also exceptional. And when Brett came on, we had a lot of conversations about how to depict mental illness and mental health without diagnosing it. I think that was a real conversation for us, is that in the book he is diagnosed specifically, and I felt very strongly that I did not want to diagnose him if we couldn't have the time to talk about what the diagnosis is. Mm. I didn't feel like it was responsible to say, well, you're this, and then a kid is watching it and they go to their parents and they're like, well, I'm depressed. Am I this too? And that is a real fear for me. And I also feel that we don't often talk about the gray area of mental health at all, which is, who knows what it is when you're feeling it. You know, it doesn't matter at a certain point what it's called. You just know you feel this way and you don't know how to communicate it. So that was really important to us. And honestly, having Elle and Justice as involved as they were, and they were really, really involved, not only in prep, but then obviously when we were in production, and every day we were talking about it and trying to make sure that we were being honest and that they felt comfortable with what they were doing and the characters they were presenting. And, you know, it was a really personal movie for everybody. So it was just about, I think, genuinely, and it sounds like a easy common sense answer, but I don't think we say it enough, was just paying attention and trying to be thoughtful and ask questions.
Sorry, I'm just going to appreciate that answer for a moment. You don't hear that often. Okay, so to the home stretch, two final questions.
Yes.
Single image from the history of cinema that is indelible for you. Mm. Like the one single shot or transition.
Transition. People have mentioned cuts that have been very meaningful.
But like, what's the one that just like, you know, you just come back to as a touchstone over and over and over and over again?
There's two that I can think of. Great. Maybe three.
But we will accept more than one answer.
Okay, great. The first one I would say is the shots in All the President's Men when Dustin Hoffman, it's a wide angle of the Washington Post offices or wide shot, and there's Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman are in the back right corner typing.
It's a good one.
And on the other, or in the foreground, it's Redford's in the foreground, Dustin Hoffman's next to him, and in the background is Nixon.
Yeah.
And he's just been reelected, and the rest of the staff is watching it and they're typing. And it's just a long shot of that. And that for me was really like, that says everything you need to know about the movie. That says everything you need to know about the power of the film and the power of what these two men are doing and why it's separate from everybody else. So that, the last shot in The Silence of the Lambs. I mean, I could probably do any shot in Silence of the Lambs, but when he walks away and he says, I'm going to have a friend for dinner, that's pretty amazing. Yeah. And it's one of the only, I think, crane shots in that movie. It's really one of the only.
Oh, yeah.
If not the only. So it's really, and it's him disappearing into the world again.
Right.
So I'll say that. And then I'll probably go with Seven, which is The Box.
Yeah. I think that those are three phenomenal answers.
Thank you.
I was thinking you would maybe mention one that always sticks out to me is the trick cut in Silence of the Lambs when you're like, oh my God, they're a Buffalo Bills house. No, they're not. Yeah. Clarice is it. But yeah, it's just like, oh man.
I mean, you can also, like, for me, the sequence that's one of the most masterfully edited shot and performed sequences is the scene one of the first interviews between Clarice and Hannibal Lecter where they jump the line.
Oh, yeah.
And I heard Demi talking about it at one point and he was like, everybody told me you can't jump the line. Right. You can't jump the line. And it's like, but I wanted people to be Hannibal and Clarice. And he was like, this is the only way I could do it. And it's such a genius answer. And it, again, sounds like common sense, but if you are having Clarice stare at you and tell you these answers, and then you're flipping and you're staring at Hannibal Lecter, there's no other way to feel except both of them. And it's really powerful.
It is indeed.
All right. Final question to take us home. What is the one movie, if you could hold a worldwide screening that everybody was watching a movie at the same time, what is the movie that you would like all of humanity to experience?
Oh, man, he's going to yell at me. Moonlight? I think we're in a pretty fucked up world right now, so it wouldn't be bad to watch that.
And that is a great way to close. Shout out to Barry Jenkins.
Thanks so much.
And Terrell McCraney.
Yeah.
Barry and Terrell.
Yeah. And everyone.
And yeah, because that movie is damn near perfect.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Liz. From Luminary Media, the Blacklist podcast is a production of The Blacklist and Ninth Planet Audio. Our executive producers are Franklin Leonard, Kate Hagen, Han Zani, and Jimmy Miller. Gabrielle Horton is our lead producer. Nicholas Pertel composed our theme music, and this episode was engineered, edited, and mixed by Kevin Liu. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at ThatHagenGirl, ThatHagenGrrl. You can find Franklin on Twitter at Franklin Leonard and on Instagram at Franklin J. Leonard. And you can find The Blacklist on both Twitter and Instagram at The Blacklist, ThebLCKLST.